the market's just gone very far, very quickly this year. We haven't had any type of correction so far at all. Markets are very overbought, very deviated from long-term trends. So again, just from a function of just, you know, buyers buying, there is a kind of a point where buyers just kind of reach the point of exhaustion. And we're
welcome to Thoughtful Money. I'm Thoughtful Money founder and your host, Adam Taggart, welcoming you back here at the end of another week, featuring my good friend, abiding portfolio manager, Lance Roberts. Lance, any idea why I chose the word abiding?
Because I stick to the rules.
No, because you're on vacation, dude, and I just think of you like the Big Lebowski. You're just sitting there abiding, dude.
Yeah, this is true. This is true.
This is true. Although you are disappointing. I was kind of expecting, you know, sort of a bit of a floral print shirt, maybe a fruity drink in hand with a little paper umbrella in it. But you got your work get up on.
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm having to actually work a lot over the spring break. So markets don't sleep.
Yeah. Is it no good vacation ever goes unpunished?
That's correct.
All right. Well, folks, a couple quick things before we dive into the weekly market recap. First, if you are watching this the morning this video is releasing, Saturday morning the 16th, Lance and I will actually be busy in parallel, in a parallel universe, running the Thoughtful Money Spring Conference. And actually, if you want to still get in on it, you can turn this off, go jump into the conference, watch the whole day. Even if you're getting it through, you're jumping in half the day through, everybody who registers is going to get all the replay videos anyways. So you're not going to miss anything. You're going to be sent the videos of the entire event. So to go do that, if you're interested, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. If you're watching this after Saturday, don't worry. If you go to that same URL, you can buy the replay videos of the entire event. And then after the event ends, I am going to follow Lance's lead and I am going to be on vacation for next week. There will be a couple of videos. We may have a day or two off from our normal relentless schedule. One thing I do want to note, though, which is on Wednesday, this is a Fed release week. On Wednesday, there's going to be a press conference with Jerome Powell. I will hop off the beach and get on with Axel Merck, and we're going to do a live reaction to, you know, whatever the Fed talks about. The premium subscribers to our Substack are going to be able to watch and participate in that live and ask questions of Axel. Everybody else will get a replay the next day. All right. Well, look, Lance, getting to the week. Bit of a flat week for the markets. They're pretty much looking like they're going to end up around where they started. NASDAQ, maybe a little bit worse off for the wear. You know, we'll pull up the charts. We'll get into, you know, what everything's telling us. But I want to ask you this question to kind of look in the context of the recent market action, which is we've seen some you know, more inflation data come in that show it's still proven pretty sticky. And, you know, is that beginning to give the market pause here where they might be thinking, look, you know, Powell may not ride to the rescue as fast as we all thought?
Yeah, no. So a couple of things. One, there's a lot of anomalies in the data that occur, you know, at the end of the year and at the beginning of the year. So November, December, January, February, you get, you know, end of the year repricing for health insurance and a lot of things like that. So, you know, don't read too much into what's going on with the inflation data over the last couple of weeks. Also, home prices, rental rates, all that is still working on a big lag. So that hasn't come through yet either. So again, you know, what's going on with inflation right now is nothing out of the ordinary. Again, we look at inflation on a year-over-year basis. So we'll see this start to taper off as we get, you know, later into the year. So, you know, no, I don't think it changes the Fed stance at all at this point. The only thing that's happened is that the market's now realigned itself. It was expecting 5 to 7 rate cuts this year. As of yesterday, it's now down to 3, which is exactly what the Fed is projecting for this year. The Fed's never put a timeline on those rate cuts. It's all, as we've said here, you know, we expect them to be later this year. Could even be first part of next year. So, you know, there's the one thing that may be out there that hangs the market up a bit is if the Fed potentially shifts its dot plot a little bit higher, or if they start to talk about, yeah, well, we're going to keep watching the data right now. We're not, you know, we're not to the point of cutting. And maybe all of a sudden we start talking about higher for longer in terms of the Fed rate hikes, and that we don't get a cut like I'm predicting until next year.
Okay, yeah. And I just want to pull up this headline that I saw literally right before I hopped on with you here, Lance. But, you know, front page of Yahoo Finance, it's time to stop waiting for the Fed. So it does seem that, you know, the narrative is beginning to cool off a little bit in terms of how quickly the Fed's going to be riding to the rescue here. And we've talked a bit about this, you know, it could be because of the sticky inflation that the Fed is saying, look, you know, we're going to wait and see a little bit longer. It could be because markets have risen so incredibly far, so incredibly fast, and financial conditions have really loosened. It could be because unemployment is still under control. Like there's not a lot of traditional demands for cutting going on right now, right? In fact, you know, one could make the argument the Fed should need to be a little bit more worried about the economy overheating, you know, than having to ride to the rescue with easing. Now, of course, you know, what Powell and the Fed officials have been saying is, well, we don't want to wait until inflation's at 2% to start cutting, because then momentum will carry us too low. Although, to be honest, I don't know too many people that would cry about, you know, too low inflation for a while. But whatever, the Fed's got its arbitrary 2% target there. So anyways, but it seems that, like, you know, I mean, well, once it starts creeping into the headlines of mainstream outlets like Yahoo Finance, we're like, oh, you know what, maybe the Fed's not gonna ride to the rescue as fast as we've been expecting. Theoretically, that should, you know, get reflected somewhat in asset prices. Not saying that's the reason why things are flat this week, but it could be a contributor.
Well, no. First of all, look, the market's just gone very far, very quickly this year. We haven't had any type of correction so far at all. Markets are very overbought, very deviated from long-term trends. So again, just from a function of just, you know, buyers buying, there is a kind of a point where buyers just kind of reach the point of exhaustion, and have kind of been there for a while. You know, you take a look at company, you know, we talk a lot about NVIDIA and AMD and these AI companies that have just surged straight up, you know, since November of last year. There's also a ton of other companies that, if you look at, have gone just vertical in the last several months, companies that really make no sense. Like Williams-Sonoma is up over 100% from its 2022 lows. You take a look at Wingstop as an example. Right. You know, makes, you know, chicken wings. They trade at 30 times price to sell. I mean, it's just a bunch of ridiculousness that's in there.
Carvana too, isn't that one of those stories?
Yeah. And so it's just, you know, it's just a lot of that kind of nonsense going on. We see a lot of the meme trades are back as well. So, you know, again, it's just a function. Markets have gone very far. But, you know, as I've said before, if I was the Federal Reserve, I'd be sending the message right now that not only am I not going to cut rates, it may be a long time. Again, if I'm the Fed, I'm looking at the fact the economy is growing very strongly. There's no sign of an economic slowdown from the economic data. Now, I'm not talking about real world stuff. I'm talking about the economic headlines. According to the economic headlines, you know, there's no economic slowdown going on. There's no threat of a recession. Take a look at the inflation data. It's hanging in there. So, you know, you're not seeing inflation come down as sharply as you would expect during a recession. So the Fed's got 5.5%, you know, 5.3% interest rates. The mid rate out there is 5.25 to 5.3. And the economy is doing fine. You don't have any cracks in the financial system. Credit spreads are extremely low. So why cut rates? I'd be sitting on my hands going, I'm just going to let y'all deal with it. And then at some point I'll cut rates if I need to. But right now, why waste the ammo I've got to offset a future recession? But again, you know, that's me, but you know, I'm not the Fed.
Let me ask you this question. So I've asked you this question before, and maybe it's just time to re-ask it. Having talked with your colleague there at RIA, Michael Leibowitz, you know, he's sort of expressed the mindset of the Fed isn't, he doesn't think it's confidence that it's going to achieve its mission that is driving the Fed to jawbone about rate cuts here. It's that the Fed actually is nervous about some things that it's not telling us. And as we head here into Q2, you know, there are some things going on that could disrupt the steady rise in net liquidity in the system. Yep. And maybe that's why Powell isn't delivering the Lance Roberts narrative here.
Right. Well, no, I mean, obviously the Fed's worried about something. Otherwise, you wouldn't be talking about cutting rates, right? So, you know, is it net liquidity? Maybe. I mean, net liquidity is rising. Bank reserves are okay. They're actually going up since October of 2022. There's a correlation between bank reserves and markets, which is why the market bottomed in October of 2022. So again, I know there's a lot of headlines and a lot of rhetoric out there that says, oh, there's this potential for a crisis. Well, there's always a potential for a crisis, right? Somebody could launch a nuclear bomb at some point, but the reality of what's going on and the reality of what's happening versus what expectations are. And again, I'm only talking about anecdotally, again, right? Is just, if you look at the economic data headlines, doesn't seem to be anything wrong. You know, but maybe there is. And yeah, Mike's right. Maybe there's something the Fed's worried about or should be worrying about that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah. And look, I'm fresh off of recording, you know, a whole bunch of presentations for tomorrow's conference. And a common theme is sort of, you know, we'll see what happens, what the implications are. But you've got the expiration of the BTFP, which has been net liquidity supportive. You've got the reverse repo program that looks like it's going to get drained, which has been liquidity supportive. You've got tax season, which just pulls in a lot of capital that otherwise would go into the markets, all kind of happening at the same period of time. Right now, is that what the Fed's worried about? I got no idea, to be honest, right? But I think, you know, these are some of the things, not quite as remote as somebody detonating a nuclear bomb, hopefully. But, you know, reasons to kind of, you know, be concerned. Who knows, again, whether that's driving Powell, certainly not driving the market, at least right yet. But let's just put our finger on inflation for just a little bit longer. So we got the most recent PPI data this week, the producer price index. It jumped up to 0.6% year over year. That's double the Dow Jones estimate. 0.6% on the month over month, but that was double the estimate that folks were expecting. Let's just say that inflation does, you know, continue to be resistant to the Fed's efforts, and let's say it continues to creep up, and it should creep up probably over the next couple months just from the base effect math alone. But let's say the data shows that it's just higher than folks were really expecting, including the central planners. How does that change the game at all market-wise here? Would the markets have to force some sort of repricing, or can they just not care about it continually?
Yeah, I think the markets are starting to see through this stuff. I mean, even after the hotter than expected PPI report, the market held up just fine. So, you know, you're not seeing any real implication, at least from the market action at this point, that they're showing any real concern. The whole focus remains on the Fed cutting rates, right? So it's like, will the Fed cut rates? And the only thing, again, that we've seen happening from these inflation reports is just the market repricing from, oh, I'm going to get 5 to 7 rate cuts to 3. That's all that's happened. The market keeps going up. So again, yeah, maybe, you know, there's some implications. But again, look, you have, like I said, you've got a lot of seasonal effects that are going on. All this data is going to get revised in the future. So they're going to come back and revise all this data lower in the next 6 to 12 months. So again, you know, what you're seeing now is a lot of estimates. Almost all of the inflation push came from energy on the PPI side. So, you know, energy was up 4%. So again, you know, a lot of this will feed through, and then you're going to get the residual effects on the other side as energy prices come back down. Rental prices are going to come down. Home prices are still falling. So, you know, those are also going to feed through into the measure of inflation. And as the economy does slow, the economy is slowing down, by the way. You know, we've gone from 9% to basically, you know, 2.5-3% growth. So that is slowing down. And so as economic growth slows down, so will inflation. And that's just going to take time to get there. It's not going to happen overnight.
So let me ask you this then. So I had a really interesting conversation yesterday with Bill Fleckenstein, which is going to release the day after this video releases. And, you know, Bill made a comment that I made a note I wanted to get your thoughts on, where he said, there's been so much like distortion in the market, largely due to things like passive income flows and just this tremendous amount of excess liquidity that's been sloshing around. Yep. Where he said it, the market has ceased becoming a leading indicator that gives us any good useful information, and it's really now just more of a lagging indicator. So, for example, like you were talking about, the market having to continually reevaluate or change its expectations on rate cuts, right? Because of, it was pricing 7 earlier this year. Now it's just pricing 3. But that was the story for all of 2023, right? They kept expecting a pivot. Powell kept saying no, and the market kept having to blink, and it didn't matter, right? Prices just still kept going up and up and up. Like it didn't matter at all what the market's inflation expectations were. Prices just kept rising. And could it be that there is just so much of this, you know, ocean of liquidity sloshing around that it kind of drowns out everything else? And, you know, at some point the markets don't become a good, like people say, oh, you know, nothing you can think of isn't priced into the markets. And Bill was kind of saying like, it doesn't really matter at this point. Like, I don't think that's the case. I think all the market's really reacting to are these big flows. Someday, probably when those flows start receding, yes, all that will become true again, but it's not true now.
I don't know. It, maybe. I mean, you know, the flows that are certainly going on are certainly important to the market, right? I'm not denying that at all. And, you know, this whole flow into ETFs, we've talked about the bifurcation of the market because of the ETF flows, et cetera. But let's go back in history and let's just talk about markets versus expectations for a moment. So in 2022, everybody thought we were going to have a recession. The market bottomed in October of 2022 and turned up. Everybody still thought we were going to have a recession. The market was saying no recession back in October of 22. All during 23, everybody was expecting a recession, right? Market kept going up, saying, nope, don't see a recession on the rising. Earnings started recovering. Economic activity started improving. All through 23, kept getting stronger and stronger. And now finally in 2024, the market's now going, oh yeah, well, yeah, we just got the, just today, just this past week, S&P released their earnings for 2025, expecting the S&P earnings to grow to $251 a share. That's just a massive jump from where we are now. So, you know, now the market and the analysts and everybody else is like, okay, well, yeah, now there's no recession. And so we have to start, you know, ratcheting up earnings expectation, economic growth, no recession. So to say that the S&P wasn't a leading indicator is really kind of not a true narrative, because the S&P has been saying for a year and a half, there's no recession.
Yeah. And look, you know, they say traditionally bull markets love to climb a wall of worry. Everybody was certainly worried back in October of 2022, right? You could almost make the argument that, you know, was the market saying there was going to be no recession, or was just because liquidity flows switched, the liquidity flows just powered everything, and that became the rationalization for it, right? I don't know. I just thought it was for a seasoned guy like him.
I'm just saying, look, the market's a leading indicator, right? Because of investors. The market's not a thing in and of itself, right? The market's not, there's not a computer out there called the market, and the computer's looking at all this data going, okay, yeah, I don't think there's a recession, so I'm gonna start driving the index higher. No, it's the group of intelligence of
it's a hive mind.
Right. It's a hive mind that drives the market. And while, you know, you and others were sitting around going, oh, recession, 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 the hive mind was saying, nope, no recession, you're wrong, and started running prices back up again and expectations of earnings growth and all this type of stuff. And that's why we've been bullish for the last year and a half, right? The market was telling you that there was not going to be a recession, you know, and why we started allocating, you know, assets to equities. I got a bunch of grief from your followers because of that. You know, but that's what's been the nature of the beast. And so the market leads the economy by about 6 months. So, you know, and the economy's been getting stronger, not weaker. So, you know, I'm not sure where you can say it's not a leading indicator, because it's absolutely leading the way.
Okay. Well, I'll let folks watch the session with Bill, and then maybe we can revisit it afterwards once everybody kind of hears both sides. I just found it interesting that a guy that you know, clearly has been a long-term seasoned market participant, not unlike you, Lance, you know, this impression. Yeah. And of course, differences of opinion are what make a market, right?
Right.
All right. Look, I've got some, let me put it this way. I've got some evidence here that we may be seeing the lag effect beginning to become more visible in the real world around us. I know you've also got some pieces that you've written, you know, despite the current resilience of the economy. I know you've got some warnings about how overstretched the market is, and I think you've written two pieces on that recently. Yep. I guess real quick before we do, though, do we want to pull up the S&P chart that we look at every week just to get a quick sense? And if there's anything on Simplevisor, the Simplevisor platform as well. By the way, you were you were telling us, I don't know, a couple of weeks ago that you guys were going to be launching a brand new version of that. Is that fully out in the world yet?
No, not yet. We're getting pretty close. We're putting the final kind of touches on it, and we're adding some new tools to it. So probably be another month or so, but we're getting pretty close.
Okay. When it is, we'll dedicate, half of this weekly market recap that week. It does go fully live for you can walk folks through exactly all the bells and whistles and benefits.
So just from a technical base, there is something kind of interesting going on over the last couple of weeks. So we've kind of gone over this for the last couple of weeks, that the market's just kind of rising. It's been following the 20-day moving average. It's just and it's just been a regular buying program. Every time the market comes down to the 20-day moving average, the computer algorithms kick in and start buying the stocks. And then as soon as it gets to the top of the trend line, the sell signals kick on and they start selling them. And during that time frame, momentum and relative strength have been starting to degrade. And it's been kind of very unusual because relative strength has remained close to overbought for quite a long time here. The MACD indicator has remained kind of stuck at a very high level for a very long time, which is fairly abnormal that it does that. And again, we've had a very, very low volatility. Kind of this climb has been very, very low volatility up to this point. But the one interesting thing is that the momentum of the rise is now slowing. And so I kind of drew this kind of this trend line across the top, and you kind of see it starting to kind of curve a bit and not keeping that same kind of sharp angle of advance that it had before. And again, this all anecdotal at the moment, but it does suggest that we're beginning to see a bit of momentum kind of weakening even in the price action. So again, nothing wrong with the markets right now. We haven't violated the 20-day moving average. We came down on Friday morning. We touched the 20-day, bounced right off of it. The market started recovering. Again, the computer algorithms just started stepping in and buying right at that level. But we are very extended here. This has been a very long advance since November. So again, we're going to get a correction, 5 to 10% at some point here. 10% correction is going to retest the 200-day moving average. And that'd be completely normal. Nothing wrong with that at all. And it'd give you a much better opportunity to put capital to work in the markets, than versus right now. So it's just it kind of the story remains the same. The market's overbought, it's extended. It's very bullish. There's nothing wrong with the market at all at this point. But again, if we break that 20-day moving average, kind of that running trend line, that's going to be a probably suggest a bigger correction. The 50-day moving average right now is sitting at 5,000. You break that, you're looking at 4,600-ish, which is the 200-day moving average. So there's some room for a correction in there. Again, completely normal. I would expect it sometime this year, and I would expect a correction before the presidential election.
Okay. So just to help folks looking at this here, the 50-day moving average is the red line. It's the lower red line here on this chart, right?
The 50-day is the blue line. The 200-day is the black line.
Oh,
And
sorry, the 20. Sorry, it's the red.
this trend line is running right along the 20-day moving average, which is this red line.
Okay, great. Yep, sorry. Thanks for confirming that. All right, so red 20, blue 50, black 200. Now, if we look down below to the RSI, relative strength index, and you've got that wedge pattern you have there. How much is it catching your attention that it seems to have just punctured below the support line there?
Well, again, this is what we've been kind of expecting, that if this market is going to deteriorate, the relative strength index is going to roll over. Hasn't done it yet. We've come down and kind of tested it, flirted with it, then turned back up, the next day, and it stays within that channel. So again, you don't really read too much in an intraday move, and this is as we're talking, it's Friday, so you don't read too much into an intraday move. What you're looking for is a weekly close that kind of really starts to suggest we've got a violation. I'm not even that worried about relative strength until we violate the 20-day moving average and kind of, trend line saying that's been kind of running along these bottoms. I'm not real worried about anything until we take out that kind of that trend line support. We're on a MACD sell signal, but we've done that before and it flips right back up again. So, again, it's just this what's abnormal is how complacent this market has been and has remained overbought as long as it have. That's not normally how the markets function. So it's certainly kind of abnormal bias, and it will end. It's just a question of when and what causes it.
Okay. So let me ask you this. What indicator would cause you to take some action in your portfolio allocation?
Break the 20-day moving average, close below it, rally back to it, fail, and then turn and go lower. And if you do that, you've got a confirmed break of that trend line, and then that's what you're looking for.
Okay. And I'm not asking for the specific trades you'll make, because you'll take that into the context of what's going on, but kind of directionally, what do you think that would make you do? Would you move more to cash? Would you switch from one sector to another?
Both. Yeah, we would probably switch from growth to defense, and then raise a little bit of cash, and then see what the market does there. Again, you know, a 5 to 10% correction is not worth doing a whole lot of stuff over.
Right, because it's pretty standard that hopefully should come and go, and you know, the market then recovers after that eventually.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And that's normally what happens. And just like October, you know, June, July, August, September, October last year had that 10% correction, and it was a good buying opportunity. So, but there's a lot of companies that we own in our portfolio that we want to buy more of. We recently bought a small position in Palo Alto Networks. So I'd love to have a correction in the market where I could buy that one cheaper, add to that position, bring it up to target weight in the portfolio. There's other companies that we own that we've taken profits in, like Apple, and I'd love to buy some shares of that back cheaper. So, you know, there's companies that, you know, we don't need to sell a whole lot of, because we've already kind of reduced the weight of the position through rebalancing. And what we're looking for is an opportunity to put the cash we have to work in those companies that are going to run with the markets when the markets are running. Other areas that we would do is raise cash in areas and stocks that aren't performing well, and look to redeploy that cash somewhere else on, you know, opportunistically.
Okay. All right. And I guess just because you mentioned it, why Palo Alto Networks? I know they had a big correction, and largely, I think, because you said they just tweaked their guidance a little bit, not even giving disappointing guidance, just saying they're going to kind of, I can't even remember what it was. They're positioning themselves, they're repositioning to make sure that they can capitalize on their growth opportunity or whatever. And the market instantly took like a 20% haircut. But do you think the company is particularly well run, or just has great prospects, or as long as folks love AI, it's going to do well?
Well, no, I mean, you know, with what Palo Alto Networks does, and particularly in cybersecurity in that area, you know, yeah, their earnings were good. Fundamentally, the company is killing it on all cylinders. And they said they're going to reposition, you know, to make sure they can maintain longer term growth. It was actually a good move that the company made, and the stock was down 26% on earnings day. So we bought a very small little starter position. It rallied off of that. It's coming back here a bit. So we may get an opportunity to, you know, add into that position and continue to build it out. Plus Nancy Pelosi bought a position in it. So why not?
Exactly. Well, you can't go wrong if you're following her trades.
Yeah.
Actually,
we bought ours before her, so it's okay.
Okay. Well, that's because I'm sure she watches this program. And when she said, Lance is in, sign me up, right? Her husband to buy a bunch of...
somehow I doubt that, but okay.
All right. Well, look, do you want to talk about either of your recent pieces, since we're still here kind of on market valuation side of things? You know, I don't want to, they're cautionary, right? They're not, you know, prepare for anything perhaps beyond a 5 to 10% correction, but they advance your thesis of, hey, look, we're pretty stretched here, and some sort of correction is, you know, some sort of pullback is to be expected.
Yeah. Which one do you want to start with?
You know, I didn't even see your most recent one here. I was thinking of the digital currency and gold as speculative warnings, you know, just basically saying there's a lot of speculation going on in the market, but start with whatever one you want.
Okay. We can start with that one. Because we also did the one on presidential election cycles, which is also kind of sets up the case for the summer correction. I thought this was interesting. Just, you know, fair statement, this is just analysis. I'm not making a case. In fact, if you scroll to the bottom of this article, it says not a recommendation. So, you know, just and what this was, it was just pure analysis. I'm not making a case. If you're long gold, I don't care. You know, that's a you thing. I'm just making, what I started digging into the data what jumped out to me is that we're seeing a very similar speculative push in a multitude of assets all at the same time. And that's very common that you see that near peaks of market cycles where it's just basically everything's going up. So everybody's buying everything. And, you know, everybody's got a theme, you know, everybody's got a thesis for why they own it, right? So I'm going to buy stocks because this is my thesis about a bull market. I'm going to buy, I'm going to buy Bitcoin because, you know, Bitcoin's going to be the replacement for, you know, the currency. And I'm going to buy gold because the end of the world's going to be, you know, whatever your thesis is. This has nothing to do with that. I don't care what your thesis is. This is simply technicals and correlations. That's all this is. But we were going through, we were looking at, looking at how investors are currently at it. So if we look at the dumb money index, which is how dumb money or retail investors are allocated to the markets. And ever since the beginning of the year, institutions, smart money has been selling stocks to dumb money. Remember that for every buyer, there has to be a seller. So if retail investors are piling into equities, somebody's got to be selling to them, right? So just, you know, we can't have a transaction without two sides to every transaction. So if you measure what's going on, and this is kind of the interesting case, dumb money has been, you know, rising strongly ever since really kind of that October low. They were already pretty bullish going into that sell-off in the summer, pulled back a bit, and then really started kind of ramping it up. But if we subtract out the smart money from the dumb money, we see this very big spike in kind of dumb money investing. And that's just kind of reached levels that normally coincide with at least short-term market tops. It doesn't mean massive corrections. I'm not talking about a crash, nothing like that. It's just corrections, 5 to 10%. Sometimes it's more, sometimes it is a recession, type sell-off. You get 20 or 25% downside, but more often than not, it's a 5 to 10% correction. Sentiment Trader, which puts out a bunch of great research and had also their sentiment cycle enthusiasm index, which is also near record levels. And again, suggesting that you've got a lot of exuberance in the market. So if we take that enthusiasm, kind of look across the market. So of course, you know, take a look at a company like Nvidia that's trading at, you know, 33 times price to sales. At the time I wrote this article, it's now 37 times price to sales because the price keeps going up. It's just, you're paying a lot. And this isn't even the most expensive company. Wingstop actually has a higher price to sales ratio than Nvidia. They're not even an AI. They just sell chicken wings. So figure that out, right? But you take a look at companies like, a lot of these meme stocks that are out there getting chased right now, SCMI, the super microcomputer in the small cap stock space, up like 1,000% this year. So, it's just, you see that kind of speculative activity in stocks. And so I started kind of looking around at other markets and started looking at, kind of the deviations from the norm in other markets. And so it's important to understand standard deviation, which is how things move from norm. And if you take a group of people and you can measure their activities and you kind of get this normalized bell curve about how people act, but markets work the same way, stocks work the same way. And so, one standard deviation encompasses 68.2% of all potential price movement up and down, right? So 34% of the time in one standard deviation, it'll be higher than the moving average. 34% of the time, it's gonna be lower than the moving average. If you step that out, you add another 27.2% to that, that's two standard deviations. So now you're up in the 95% range of all standard movement within two standard deviations. And once you get to three standard deviations, four standard deviations from the norm, you're talking about 99.9999% of all potential price movement is already priced into whatever activity has occurred. So that's basic, kind of a basic explanation of standard deviation. I explain this in more detail in the article. Relative strength is also a measure of the movement. And so I explain relative strength in the article as well. If you don't know what that is, you can just read the article and get a definition. But if you take a look at Nvidia, it's trading more than three standard deviations above its 50-day moving average. So it's just very, again, at the time I wrote this article, it's come back a little bit since then. But at that time, it's trading with a relative strength index of well over 70. It was above 80 at that point. 70 is very overbought. So You've got a lot of, you know, basically everybody's going to buy something has been buying it. And when you're four standard deviations above its moving average, you know, you've priced in the bulk of whatever advance it was going to make. So if you're expecting it to just keep going up, odds are likely that's not the case. You know, we've talked about stretching a rubber band previously. You only stretch it so far before it kind of comes back to the norm. But then I started looking at other assets, and then I looked at gold, and gold's trading well into three standard deviation territory, almost four. It's been a vertical spike up, and it's trading well above set. Well, it was, again, this was a few days ago, was trading well above 70 on the relative strength index, something it doesn't do very often, but it does from time to time. And then you normally get a correction in gold prices after that. And the same thing with Bitcoin, which is just kind of gone parabolic since the launch of ETFs, trading with a relative strength index. It was actually near 90 at one point. It cooled off a little bit. But again, so you just see kind of the same narrative across all these assets of just the speculative investing. And I said, okay, well, let's take a look at the index versus these other items. And so I had, because of the price disparities between gold, the stock market, and Bitcoin, I had to rebase everything to 100. So going back to 2015, rebase everything to 100. You can see that when the market's going up, gold has been basically tracking the market. And this is this was interesting to me because, you know, if you think about gold, right, gold's an inflation hedge. And we had 9% inflation in 2022, and gold went down with the market. So it didn't really hedge you for inflation at 9% during 2022. Since the bottom of the market in 2022, it's been rallying with stocks. So it's become much more correlated to the stock market than really the dollar or anything else. So if you really kind of want to know what direction gold's going to take in the near term, watch the stock market, because again, it's become an asset that kind of trades with the market. Bitcoin, obviously, very much similar. It rebased these two to 100. Peaks and valleys almost correlate identically with what's going on in the stock market. And if you look at Bitcoin versus gold, you kind of see the same correlation pop back up. So again, it's just interesting to me that, you know, we've got such a speculative narrative to this market and so much. And again, this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, just so much money piling into the market that it's just looking for somewhere to go. So it's just now kind of going into any asset class that's moving, whatever's moving up, I'm just going to buy that asset because it's going to keep moving up. And so you're seeing the same thing kind of all across the market.
All right. So this kind of goes back to the discussion that I was having with Bill Fleckenstein. You know, if kind of all correlations are going to one and they're all showing like excessive speculation, right? You know, every chart there was in the three standard deviations or higher range, right? You know, does that make you worried that you know, the market is vulnerable for another sort of 2022 scenario where when it does reverse, I'm not saying by how much, but that kind of everything goes down together because it's all rising together right now?
Yeah, no, I would precisely expect that to happen. I suspect that when, and in fact, if you, let me pop back to the article real quick, because let me just go down to the very last part where I say, not a recommendation. This is not a recommendation, right? This is just research. But I said, there are many narratives surrounding, this is the last two paragraphs. There are many narratives surrounding the markets, digital currency and gold. However, in today's market, more than in previous years, all assets are getting swept up into the investor feeding frenzy. Sure, this time could be different. I'm only making an observation and not an investment recommendation. However, from a portfolio management perspective, it will likely pay to remain attentive to the correlated risk between asset classes. If some event causes a reversal and bullish exuberance, cash and bonds may be the only safe place to hide.
Great. So let me ask about that. Cash, totally understandable. Now, bonds, I mean, the big surprise of 2022 was that bonds went down with stocks and everything else, right? There kind of almost was no place to hide besides cash, right? If you just wanted to preserve your capital, right? Has that correlation diverged between stocks and bonds so far enough where you think that they'll play the ballast role again?
We're seeing much more of that, you know, case over the year or so that, you know, in market down days, we've seen bonds rise. In market up days, we see bonds goes down. So they become more non-correlated as of late. And again, you know, after 3 years of having a bear market. And again, bonds are strictly a function of economic inflation and economic growth. So as those two continue to decline, and then if you throw in stress on top of that into the financial markets, which will also probably accelerate Fed rate cuts, then bonds should play very well. Because as soon as the Fed starts cutting rates, yields are going to fall because yields will track Fed rate cuts. So again, that's kind of all you're waiting for the yield story to play out on bonds.
Okay. All right, you had two other articles. We don't necessarily have to go through them all, but I certainly the presidential one I read was interesting. I know we talked a little bit about that last week. Is there any more on that that you want to mention for folks?
No, I think just the reality is that, you know, going into the, you know, if you want to try to time out the risk for some type of sell-off in the market, I think you really have to start looking at the, you know, that those couple of 3 months right before the election. I think that's the you know, we with this market kind of flop around. I mean, we could certainly have a correction before then, but, you know, I think within that 3 month window to the November election, that I think that's where you're going to see a lot of rhetoric ramp up. You're going to see a lot of, you know, accusations flying back and forth. And that's probably going to make the market nervous and not want to be, you know, heavily long going into the election, not knowing the outcome.
Wait a minute, what? Rhetoric during an election year? What?
Yeah, can you imagine that? Mudslinging, et cetera?
All right, well, your other new piece, which looks like it's about the household situations or the condition of the American household. Let me bring up this article that I wanted to walk through with you because it's got some good charts and maybe you can pull in any elements from your recent article that are relevant. Sure. So here's a piece from Bloomberg. American debt stings like never before in new era for households, right? So there's a couple of stats I've got here that I think show that, you know, we are beginning to see a manifestation of the lag effect, at least in consumers and potentially now creeping into consumer spending, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, this article is basically profiles of a number of different people who are, In some of their words, this, one of these women here is quoted saying, I'm making more than I've ever made before, and yet I'm finding it harder to get by than it's ever been before, right? Mm-hmm. Where the cost of living and the cost of credit is really beginning to bite. So you'll see here interest payments by U.S. households, both mortgage and non-mortgage are increasing again. Non-mortgage related interest payments, these are things like credit cards, auto loans, and whatnot, are just shooting the moon here in the past, you know, year plus. Let's see here. This is the woman who said, yeah, I'm making the most money I've ever made, and I'm still living paycheck to paycheck. There's a wild disconnect between what people are experiencing and what economists are experiencing. And, you know, I spent a lot of time reading articles. I'm seeing a lot more like this in the media, but I will just say anecdotally, in terms of the people that reach out to me via social media, email, and whatnot, I'm hearing just a lot more of this going on. This, oh, yeah. Like, wait, I'm being told one thing, but it is just not matching my my lived experience. Households take on debt faster than before the financial crisis. This is aggregate U.S. credit card balances. They've just surpassed over $1 trillion for the first time ever. A reminder that the APRs on this credit card debt are at record highs as well. So not only do we have by far the highest consumer debt balance in credit cards, but it's costing folks the most as well. Obviously, this hits lower the meager and moderate household much more than it does the high net worth household. There's one or two other charts here I wanted to show. So the chart title here is lowest earners see the biggest increase in delinquencies, which is true. That's the black line here. But you'll see delinquencies for everybody is going up here, right? And you can see they were at some crazy low back here in 2021 where they weren't even processing delinquencies and there was forbearance and everybody was getting their checks and all that stuff. But you can see the trajectory here amongst all quartiles, right? Even the quite wealthy are on an upward trajectory here. So, you know, and they're basically citing, you know, higher borrowing costs are the things that are keeping people up. The return of student loan payments has a lot of people stressed out. So you're just seeing, you know, more and more signs in the real economy of the people that are having to get up every day, live their lives, that it's getting tougher and tougher. And I just want to combine this with some recent other news. So retail sales, they disappointed in February. They did rise, but they rise less than folks were expecting. And the big miss on retail sales that was reported in January was revised down even further, right? Somewhat to be expected. Your consumers are struggling. They're beginning to actually, pull back on their pocketbooks. And then the New York Fed's manufacturing survey just came in at negative 20.9, which is, still in contraction. And I know we are not a manufacturing, nearly as much of a manufacturing economy, Lance, as we used to be, but this thing's been stuck in contraction for like the past 2 years. So, there's just lots of data that's out there that are just showing that spending's beginning to slow. People are beginning to, really begin to get to the pain point of I'm living paycheck to paycheck. I don't know how much more I'm going to be able to do that. And it's beginning to creep more and more into the economic data. Now, you've said, the economy is slowing down. I think the big question this all raises is how far is the momentum going to continue from here?
Well, I think, first of all, too, and I think this brings up a good point that, if you take a look at a lot of the data that economists throw out, kind of the mainstream economists are like, oh, don't worry about the economy. Look at the debt to income ratios, right? It's still very low. It's way below where it was, pre-pandemic. If you take a look at the savings ratio, right? It's households have a bunch of excess savings. Nothing to worry about in the economy. Well, the problem with all of that is that it's heavily skewed by the top 10% of income earners who have a lot of cash and no debt.
Right, it's mean versus median, right?
And I've done analysis on this before. I've written articles about it saying, you got to be really careful with that data. So it's not nearly as robust as it looks. And this is why, there's this big, this big dichotomy between, what the economists say and then everybody else on the street going, my life, I'm barely making ends meet. I can't, buy my groceries and, inflation's killing me, blah, blah, blah. But yet the economic data says everything is just fine. So again, that's why you've got to really parse a lot of this headline data with what's happening in the real world and keep a watch on the real-time indicators that, actually impact the average American. And so when you take a look at, how much money they have in savings, $500, those type of things. There's a very short runway between where they are right now and basically being in bankruptcy.
Well, so let's pull up to the higher level here for a second. How concerned are you about this, right? The affluent, they're overspenders, right? Like they spend disproportionately. They're big supporters of the economy. As long as asset prices, continue to go up, they're the primary benefits of that, and that will manifest to a certain extent in more spending from them. But if the majority of the country, continues to sort of slump downwards into this, just hanging on by their fingernail stage, and more and more people actually lose their grip, can the affluent, household kind of keep this thing afloat? Or at some point, does the math tip where it says, look, there's just enough people who are really having hard times that it really is going to impair the ability of the economy to grow?
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the 20% can't support 80% forever, right?
Basically, my question.
The bottom 80% spends almost the entirety of their check living. They live basically paycheck to paycheck. There's very little excess savings. So yeah, the 20%, they can, spend above their norms for a while. But at some point, even the affluent have bought everything they're going to buy. I
Right,
mean,
there are only so many jet skis you can own, right?
exactly. I mean, you've great. I went on this reserve, this kind of revenge spending post-COVID. So I've been traveling a lot. I've been doing a lot of extra stuff that I didn't do before. But after a while, you're going to go, well, okay, I've done all that, and it's going to slow down. Also, at some point, the concerns of the economy are going to weigh through. A lot of the people that are affluent are also business owners. So at some point, if that spending begins to slow down, we're seeing this, and every month when we get the NFIB report out, we're seeing, and the NFIB consumer confidence survey just rolled over again. It's heading lower again, staying in recessionary territory. But you take a look at, expectations of sales and those type of things, employment, labor, all those indicators are all getting worse So there's going to be a point to where even those affluent people, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about where this economy is. I'm going to start clamping up my spending a little bit. Just be careful. That's all it's going to take. And that'll shift that over to the other side.
Okay. And this is like, you know, if folks can, the folks that say, hey, Adam, you know, you tend to lean bearish. This is, if I do, this is sort of at the root of it, right? Which is like, I track the condition of the American consumer pretty closely and have these concerns. And I'd say that, you know, the concern I have right now is that I don't see a lot of hope, I guess, on the horizon for like a material reversal of this, where we pick up the bottom 80% or even, you know, the middle class part and start re-elevating that. I'd love to be wrong. Maybe, you know, AI is going to be this great productivity enhancer that lets everybody benefit. I'm a little afraid that AI is actually going to be a job destroyer for a lot of this cohort that we're talking about. So I don't know, like this, you know, one of the reasons why I keep revisiting this whole wealth disparity and this whole, you know, where the American consumer is going, because I feel like, to your point, Lance, you know, we're all in this boat together. And if, you know, important cohorts really start struggling, no matter where you are in the socioeconomic spectrum, it's going to impact you eventually.
Well, no, it is. And, you know, this is, you know, look, AI is not going to be a benefit to the bottom 80% of Americans. It's going to, you know, it's interesting. I just did there was a chart on Twitter I put out the other day showing productivity at multi-decade highs. And that's been a function of stock buybacks and offshoring and automation and robotics and, you know, everything else. So we've displaced a lot of labor that we've replaced with other substitutes to enhance earnings and profitability. And again, how do we measure productivity, right? It's revenue per worker. So if I have a dollar's worth of revenue and I can reduce my workers, then right, revenue per worker goes up. That's how we measure productivity. It's not, oh, I have the same number of workers and they're all just producing a whole bunch more. That's not what's going on here and hasn't been. And this is why you take a look at full-time employment. Actually, this weekend's newsletter is talking about full-time employment as a recessionary indicator, because the year-over-year rate of change in full-time.
Wait, I'm sorry. I don't know what this full-time employment is that you talk about, because apparently we haven't created any full-time jobs in like over a year.
Well, that's right. And so full-time employment itself is now negative on a year-over-year basis. And full-time employment relative to the population has also turned sharply lower. Both of those are things that occur in preceding a recessionary onset. It makes complete sense, right? Because you have to have a full-time job to pay bills and have health benefits and all those type of things. Part-time jobs don't cover that.
Okay. And this again, and then I'll get off this, like this is why I find it personally challenging to like really buy into the uber bullish case of like, hey, just don't worry, things are just going to keep heading higher, you know, for as long as we can imagine from here. And it's because I see this reckoning, I think, that is coming, which is that, hey, look, if we don't alter the current trajectory, we're going to get to that tipping point where there are too many people below the waterline where everybody gets dragged into it. Right. Now, love to be wrong. You know, I still try to keep a very open mind. I'm totally, totally open to the fact that markets could run higher for all this year. And that's why we have you here every week, Lance, is to keep us focused on the markets we have, not the markets that we think should exist. I am just sort of doing some personal, you know, sharing here, which is, you know, of all the things that sort of, you know, sit in my mind, that's probably the one that sits there the most persistently and loudly, right?
Yeah. Well, and again, you know, there's not a direct linkage between the economy and the stock market. And what I mean by that is that the stock market can deviate from the actual economics for quite some time.
Absolutely.
Unfortunately, the stock market will always return to economic realities. It's just what causes that to occur. And, you know, that's kind of evident in, you know, what we're seeing going on with a lot of the speculation chase. We're seeing it across multiple asset classes, et cetera. They're all deviating from actual economic realities. And so, again, at some point, earnings and revenue are a function of economic activity. So as that economic activity slows, so too will revenue growth and earnings. And that's where profitability becomes an issue. And you either have to maintain profit by reducing the labor force, but you can only do that so far. You can continue to outsource. You can only do that so long. And you can only buy back so many shares to reduce your earnings per share. So, you know, all these factors kind of play in. And in fact, I was just posting a chart out this morning on Twitter that we've had, without earnings, without stock buybacks, there's been absolutely negative earnings growth. So, you know, that's the problem that we've got going on. And we can kind of support this data for a while, but eventually economic realities are going to matter. Just a question of when.
All right. Well, folks, you know, if what we're saying is resonating with you, we will keep tracking all this week after week after week going forward. All right, Lance, I got a couple other quick stats, and then sure. I want to get to the rant, and I want to give you time, which you asked for last week, to talk about the difference between constitutional republic and democracy. If you still want to, if you're still amped up to do that,
whatever,
I'll give you the floor.
Whatever you want to do.
All right. Just real quick, I want to note a few stats on housing. We're beginning to see supply come onto the market in parts of the country. So particularly in the Southeast, a lot of Southern states are now seeing pretty robust double-digit increases in inventory. Florida has had a 46% increase in inventory. As so goes inventory, so should follow prices. We've had this big stalemate as the market's really frozen with higher interest rates and sellers not wanting to sell. That's beginning to change, at least in the Southeast. Let's see what happens as time goes on here. But that's not evenly distributed. So in New York, rents are actually moving back up. Finding a home in New York has, quote, become a nightmare, according to a recent report that just came out. A New York State Assembly member just warned, quote, housing affordability is at a crisis level in New York City. More than half of renters are rent burdened. New housing construction is not keeping pace with population growth. Goldman then adds on top of that, one major problem deferring new affordable housing in metro areas is that office tower prices are still too high for conversions. So what's interesting here is that, you know, New York obviously is still in the throes of its own housing freeze. Interesting that tower prices haven't come down yet, especially with all the commercial real estate issues going on. I just feel like that's probably just a matter of time. Is this a situation, Lance, where you think that high prices become the cure for high prices?
Yeah, eventually. Look, we're seeing cracks all over the commercial real estate market. You know, the one thing, though, there's a lot of people that are betting on this massive collapse that's going to come from commercial real estate. It's probably not going to happen because, and I'm not saying that prices won't go down in commercial real estate. We're not going to see, and we're seeing buildings get sold off for 20 cents on the dollar, all kinds of things that are going on. But this is such a well-known problem that the market's already working through this. And so this isn't going to be the catalyst for a financial crisis, right? Everybody's too aware of it. The bond market's aware of it. The credit markets are aware of it. The banks are aware of it. The Fed's aware of it. And so this is already getting worked through, and we'll get through it and we'll look back and go, man, there's a bunch of great deals on commercial real estate. I mean, there's going to be some people that make a killing on commercial real estate 10 years from now, because they're buying buildings at 20, 25 cents on the dollar, forcing out creditors, forcing out equity players, renovating it into either new commercial space or multifamily or whatever they're going to do with it. And there's going to be a lot of money made in that space, but it's not going to be the crisis event that everybody keeps expecting. Just like high interest rates weren't didn't cause a housing crash that
right.
Everybody heard.
And I will say, one of the person might actually be watching this video. One of the folks that has been following my work for a number of years, got to meet this person at an event, and their backstory was, they're well off, and they're well off because a grandparent, I think it was a grandmother, bought like a Central Park West property, like buildings, not just apartments, like the entire buildings, back in the 70s during one of the big real estate busts there, and basically the family after that for several generations just didn't have to work because she just bought in right at the right time, right? Sounds like you're saying we may be in a similar era like that. Now you probably have to wait maybe a decade or more before it gets back to that kind of state. But you can, it's blood on the streets in commercial real estate, or at least getting there. All right, so we don't need to spend much time on this. I just want to note it largely because we work in media here, Lance, but just curious if you've got anything you want to say about the new TikTok legislation that's out there, which basically is, in fact, I haven't really been following it that closely, but I think it's, you know, not quite a ban on TikTok, but like if it's going to be allowed to operate in the U.S., it's got to be owned by U.S. interests and not by, you know, foreign interests. I know there's a lot of kind of First Amendment freedom of speech, freedom of freedom of speech in this, because I think some folks are saying, look, the way the current bill is written, it's way too broad. And it's providing a door for the government to get in and censor media companies when they want to. But just curious if you have any thoughts one way or the other on it.
Well, yeah, this isn't a TikTok ban, right? So if you take a look at, so they say that TikTok needs to be banned because it's a Chinese company, right? But the data is housed on servers in Texas, run by Oracle. 60% of the company is owned by investors. Most of those are United States investors. 20% is owned by the employees of the company, right? So it's employee owned, and 20% is owned by the people that actually owned it. So they're Chinese, right? But the whole thesis behind why they're banning TikTok is not valid. If you actually read it, what it allows the president to do is to ban any website that they feel is acting in terms of election interference. That's what this is really getting down to. So what's going to be really interesting about this is that, you know, this authority, you're giving very broad authority to the president to act kind of in an authoritarian manner on any website that they deem to be an election threat. So this is going to be interesting to see how this works out, because obviously, you know, Twitter has run afoul of what, you know, the government wants, you know, kind of everybody to play in party line, right? So Facebook fell in line, Google fell in line. It's going to be interesting because there's already been a lot of angst about Twitter and Rumble and a lot of these other social media platforms that will potentially fall underneath this regulation if it passes. It's passed the House, but it's got to still pass the Senate. And you're starting to see a lot of people actually read the context of the ban and go, wait a minute, this isn't what we're actually being told is the reason we're banning TikTok. And it's also quite fascinating that the president just got on TikTok and started the TikTok channel maybe a month ago, and now we're going to ban it. But there's a lot of congressmen and others that have, you know, large followings on TikTok. And, you know, this is how you communicate with your, you know, the people you're trying to influence to vote for you, right? So you're putting out your policies and whatever you want. You know, you're kind of cutting off your nose to spite your face. And I'm not even sure what the real benefit of doing this is. It's, again, the data is all in Texas. The data is run by Oracle. We have access to all that data. You know, if you're worried about your data being shared, that's happening. Amazon, Google, everything you do, all that data is being shared, right? So it's, you don't have any privacy in terms of your data. So this doesn't solve any of that problem. But I don't really understand it, but I, you know, it is what they want to do.
All right. Well, let me say this. I don't have a lot of love for TikTok. I don't think it's a very good net influence on our society. And I could lump a lot of other.
Hold on a second. Wait, say that. But you have to say that in the context of, is Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, are those any better?
I'm going there. Okay. I was just literally going to say, and this is not related, this is not exclusive or contained to just the TikTok. You know, any parent, especially of preteens or teens, right, knows the toxic and corrosive effect that social media has had on our kids, right? So I'm professing no particular love for TikTok here. My concern, which you just elaborated way better than I did, is that this doesn't really even seem to be a bill that's really about TikTok in the big picture. It's about executive action to be able to basically curtail content that the administration finds problematic, right? And what worries me about that is this isn't that academic, right? We're just a few years past a time in history where we had a bunch of sweeping centralized authority decisions being made that once the dust settled, have been walked back and saying, yeah, you know what? We were probably wrong about that. We probably shouldn't have done it that way, right? And I can get into a bunch of different examples, but I don't want to stir up partisan pushback. And folks, I can come up with examples on every side of the aisle here, so I'm not going after any one particular party. But yeah, to me, that just seems like the way it's currently been described is a real Trojan horse, or no, sorry, Pandora's box, that if it got opened. And look, do I think, you know, my little corner of the media world is at risk by this? I don't think by this bill, no, but I think it definitely puts us on our trajectory that eventually, yeah, maybe one day you and I are talking and we don't like something that the current president is doing, no matter who's president at that time. And then all of a sudden, maybe some, you know, algo that's been written to sniff out anything that contradicts the official narrative, you know, bans us, right?
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. I think the thing that, you know, look, you know, the unfortunate thing that's occurred over the last several years, and this actually started under the Obama administration itself in his second term, it started getting a lot worse. But there used to be a time in history where we could all sit around and have political dialogue. And I could say, this is my view. You could say, this is your view. And we could agree to even disagree. But there was a point to where we could actually have a dialogue and you could actually get access to all the facts. And, you know, that's not even, you know, available anymore, because if there's certain facts that Google doesn't like, they get suppressed. So you can't get access to them. You know, we can't have a conversation about an issue without somebody getting offended. So nobody wants to talk about anything now because we don't want to offend you. You just said to yourself is, you know, hey, I'm not picking on anybody, so I don't want to get a bunch of emails. You know, I get it, right? You can't even have a conversation. The bigger picture, though, is you're giving one guy the authority to limit speech without really any oversight. You know, and look, if you say, look, we need a bill that says, you know, we need to stop this type of information, because this reminds me a lot of the McCarthy era when, you know, back in history, you know, we were just calling everybody was a communist at that point. If you didn't like the way they were acting, they were a communist and they got investigated. Right. And that was a terrible time in U.S. history. And we're repeating a lot of that today by a lot of these actions. And, you know, and the consequence sounds fine right now. We're going to give the president authority to do this. And you're like, yeah, that's great, right? We're going to shut down Twitter and Elon Musk and X, right? So that's awesome. Then the next president comes along and says, okay, you know what? I'm going to shut down, you know, Facebook. You're not going to have Facebook. Right. Or I'm going to shut down Instagram. So now you don't have Instagram. You know, you're giving one guy an authority to do a whole lot of stuff that these are things we should be having votes on, to where these are put out for a vote. We vote on these bills. And, you know, it's just like in the city of Houston, if you want to pass a bill to have a rain tax, which was a stupid thing we did a few years back, we taxed rainwater flow because we had too much concrete in Houston. So bill went, everybody got to vote on it and it got passed and great. So now we have a rain, it's a stupid tax, but we have a rainwater tax. You know, these are the type of things that we should be doing, right? This is how the Constitution was designed, to give a certain set of rights, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of you know, illegal search and seizure, those type of things. You know, all those rights were all laid out. And we consistently try to erode those rights under the name of national security, right? And we say, oh, we need to do this because this is a national security issue. And you wind up giving up a whole lot of your rights under this guise of national security. Well, the problem is that you're giving up more and more of your rights to be safe. And eventually you'll have no rights, but you'll be safe.
Well, it's the classic Benjamin Franklin, right? Those that would give up their freedoms in exchange for security deserve neither, right?
Yep. And that's kind of, and unfortunately, that's just that. And it's just a slippery slope, right? It's just this one bill. But then this one bill goes to another bill, and this other bill, and we've already had a bunch of these bills, right? We've done all kinds of bills to control the internet and to control information flows and all these type of things. And we've given people all kinds of rights to data and access to data. And it's all fine, right? And as long as you're happy with it, that's okay. Just realize it's a slippery slope that you're going down, and you keep giving up incremental rights under this name of national security.
All right. Well, look, let's jujitsu from this topic to your points that you wanted to make last week about the understanding the difference and appreciating the difference between a constitutional republic and a pure democracy.
Well, I just, you know, that, you know, just kind of last week, there was a bunch of a commercials and there was a lot of talk about, you know, we need to protect democracy, right? Democracy is at risk in this next election, right? So we got to have this election because we have to defend democracy. It's important to understand if you're going to go vote, and I just had this conversation, and the reason it came up, because I just had this conversation with my daughter. So she's turning 21 in April. She went registered to vote, and I'm like, set her down. And I said, okay, well, that's great. I'm so happy you registered to vote. You're going to participate in the political system. What does that mean to vote, right? We just started with a very basic, you know, kind of premise. And, you know, she says, well, we're a democracy. I go, well, stop right there, because we're not a democracy. And she goes, what do you mean we're not a democracy? I said, we're not a democracy. A democracy is mob rule, right? So it's if 51% of the people say, this is what we're going to do, it doesn't matter what the other 49% of the people want to do, that's what we're going to do. And if you take a look at how the United States is basically divided, right? You have all your major cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Houston, Dallas, Florida, Miami, New York, all your major cities, Chicago is up there. All your major cities are basically clustered in just a handful of states. So in other words, if you go to just a pure democracy, and we got out a map and we looked at where all the major cities were, basically, five states would control every outcome of every election, right? Because that's where more than 51% of the population lives. You know, states like Wyoming, states like Idaho, North Carolina, no vote. They have no say in the political process because it'll all be controlled by the major cities. And that's why a democracy is not a good system, because it is a mob rule system. We are a constitutional republic. And this was really well thought out by our founding fathers, who, you know, they came over here from an aristocracy dictatorship, came over here and said, we don't want that to ever happen again. And so they crafted out this constitution and said, this is how we're going to operate the country. We're going to have the separation of branches, rather, you know, and we're going to operate under this idea of a representative republic. And so each state will have representatives, and those representatives will basically vote on, supposed to vote, by the way, for the will of their population. So in other words, senators and congressmen from California are supposed to vote on bills and actions that comply with what Californians want. Ones from Texas are supposed to do the same thing. Now, it doesn't always work out because we've allowed too many corporations to interfere and enter our political process. But that's the way it was laid out and supposed to be structured. And this is why it's broken down the way it is. So the population for each state is broken down, and you have in Congress, you have representatives based on the population of each state, and every state has two senators. And so this is why it's broken down that way. And so that they're supposed to vote the will. And this is also why we have the Electoral College. A lot of people I've seen lately is talking about, we need to get rid of the Electoral College, right? We just need to go to the majority vote. Well, again, this is a problem, because what the Electoral College does is it gives states like Wyoming, which has a total population of 500,000 people, the same vote in the election and the electoral process that a state like California has. So this gives every state, regardless of their population, a vote and a voice within the political process. And this is why it's so important when you hear the media come out and say, well, we have to defend democracy. No, we need to defend the constitutional republic, because that's what we are. We are a constitutional republic based on a representative structure of the voice of the population. Congress and Senate and the president is supposed to work for we the people, not go do whatever they freaking want to do up there and just act willy-nilly. They're supposed to be representing the will and the action of the voting public. And this is why when we go to the poll, and this is what I was explaining to my daughter, is that you need to vote for people. I don't care what their party is vote for the person that is going to represent the things that you believe in and the things that you want and the things that are going to make the economy, your life, those a better place to be in. Don't just vote for somebody because of their one party or the other. That's the problem. And, you know, so we had this conversation, but, you know, again, it's important to understand that as a democracy, that is a mob rule. And that is nothing like how the United States is currently structured, but it is a way that we have been pushing over the last few years. The last couple of years, we've had, you know, elections that have been highly contested. And it's like, well, this person won all the popular vote. Doesn't matter. You can win the popular vote and still lose the Electoral College because of the way it's broken down. You know, that's okay. That's the way the system is supposed to work.
All right. I'm sure we're going to get a ton of comments around this. You know, I think, and I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I'm just talking off the top of my head here, but I think part of the representative form of government we have right now too is to provide, you know, accountability in the sense of like, if it's just pure mob rule, right, and everybody gets a vote, and there are implications of that vote, there's nobody to go to and hold accountable and say, well, hey, you need to do this differently next time, right? Where if there is a guy whose neck is on the line, right, you know, he's the one that everybody can go to and say, hey, we need to, you know, I've got a different opinion, or hey, we didn't get the results we wanted, we want to change tack, right? You've got somebody who's sort of at the nexus of all that. And you said that they're supposed to represent the will of their constituents. And I agree with that largely. I think, though, that the system is structured that way so that they're supposed to serve for the benefit of their constituents. Right. And this means sometimes what the constituents ask for isn't necessarily the right thing to do. And part of a representative's role at certain times is to say, look, I got to make some tough decisions that might not be necessarily politically popular in the moment, but maybe setting us up for the right benefits down the road. Really good example is, hey, you know, we just saw this, right? Inflation spiking. So what does the public demand? Well, please, you know, send a stimulus, right? And I totally get it, because families are just focused on trying to put food on the table tonight, right? But that cure is actually making the disease even worse, right? Yep. And so, you know, to a certain extent, I think back then, while very wisely, they said, look, anybody who gets the vote can be elected, you know, wins the vote can become the elected representative. There was sort of an acknowledgement of, hey, a lot of our population isn't super educated, and we're going to let the people that, you know, maybe have a greater set of skills to benefit the public good, can be making the smart decisions and just not implementing willy-nilly what 51% of the subsistence farmers are asking for right now, right? And I know that sounds kind of classist, and I'm not trying to disparage the average person. Although you go on TikTok, you see a lot of these like man on the street, you know, interviews they do, and you're like, oh my God, I can't believe we have people like that in the world, right? So there is a little bit of a safeguard, right, where you have a position that somebody has to work to earn to get, that sort of demonstrates both their commitment, but their capabilities along the way to do the job well. And then hopefully when they're there, they serve for the benefit of the populace. Now, as you said earlier, Lance, we can spend a lot of time talking about how that system has been totally perverted and corrupted by special interests and outside money and, you know, people gaming the system. And now, you know, becoming a politician, you know, if you're lucky enough to get elected, especially into national posts, I mean, it's like a gravy train, right? You know, you get lifelong benefits, you get all sorts of, you know, offers from all sorts of special interests to put you on their boards and stuff like that when you come out of office. So I'm one of the first to say, look, the system is not working the way that it was originally designed. But I appreciate what you're talking about in terms of truly understanding why it was set up the way that it's set up.
Well, and I think, though, this is also why that we need to have a serious conversation about getting corporations out of the voting process. You know, this, you know, having super PACs, having political action committees, having super PACs where, you know, these candidates can absorb a lot of money from corporations. And, you know, also the fact that, you know, corporations can make donations to politicians. Corporations are technically entities, right? But they're not voting citizens. And again, Congress is supposed to represent the will of the people, but how can they represent the will of the people if their loyalty is being bought by massive donations and keeping them in office for decades upon decades, you know, through these political campaigns, these political donations, those type of things? You know, there was a time where, yeah, it was okay that, you know, but it's gotten so egregious. And now we see that a lot of bills that are getting written, they're being written by the corporations themselves. The corporations write the bill, send it over to the lot, you know, through their lobbies and send it to the congressman. The congressman says, oh, I've got this bill and here I'm presenting this bill. And we find out that it benefits some particular company or some particular group that were heavy campaign donors for this particular congressman. And that's not, and the point is that's not the way the system is supposed to work. And to your point, it's been heavily influenced by that. So there's not an, you know, the congressmen and the senators no longer work for the people, they work for the corporations or quote unquote, they work for the people with the money. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. And there's fixes for that, right? We could just get rid of all that. We could say, look, every person that wants to donate, you can donate $500 to whatever congressman you want, right? Whatever political person, you can donate $500. And television stations, you're going to have to allot a specific, radio stations, TV stations, YouTube, whatever, you're going to have to allot a specific amount of time equally across every candidate for advertising. They can't pay for it. You can't take money for it. But as being a media outlet, this is what you're signing up for. And you're going to have to allot this amount of time. And it doesn't have to be a lot. It can be, you know, 30 second commercials, whatever it is, per candidate. And they can get their message out. And the rest of it, they're going to have to do like they did in the old day. They're going to have to do campaign stops and go town to town and knock on doors and do flyers. They're going to have to do the hard work. You know, I'm sorry, but that's what you signed up for being a congressman.
So I'm there with you, and it might be fun to riff more on the actual solutions at some point on this if folks are interested, if we haven't lost everybody already. But Lance, just to this point, I mean, you remember from your event in Houston from, yeah, what, a month and a half ago, I'm blanking the guy's name, Greg Valliere. You remember in the Q&A, you know, I asked him, I said, well, look, you know, what's the biggest problem right now with the political system? Because he was talking about a lot of the issues that it had. And I said, you know, at the root, what are the biggest problems? And I said, is it too much, you know, money in politics? And I was about to go on. He just interrupted me. He said, that's it. He said, like, that's the whole enchilada.
Right? It's the whole problem.
The system is just too corrupted. It's way too bought and paid for. So absolutely right. All right. Well, look, we'll start wrapping up here. I've just got a couple of I think updates folks are going to want to hear here. Again, a reminder, I am going to be largely taking off next week, though there will mostly be content on this channel, including the reaction to the FOMC minutes and the Jerome Powell press conference next week. So that'll be Axel Merck and I. And again, we'll be holding a live event for the premium members on our Substack. And then everybody else will get the replay video of that on this channel the day after. Reminder too, if you didn't attend the conference, really wish you had, want to get the replay video of the whole event and the live Q&As from it, just go to thoughtfulmoney.com/conference. You can purchase those replays there. I do just want to give a quick heads up about a coming improvement that's coming to Substack, to our Substack. So I'm not sure everybody really understands what you get for subscribing to the Substack. You probably, hopefully remember that that's where I publish my notes, which are my takeaways, my summaries of all the interviews that happen on this channel. So if you don't want to furiously scribble notes and just listen and then go read my summary afterwards, you get that. Or if you don't have time to listen to the full interview and just want to get the pricey of it, you can go and get it from those notes. But it also offers, the membership also acts as a discount card, as you've heard me, as I've been talking about the conference. If you are a premium Substack member, you get $50 off no matter what the price is of the conference, whether it's the early bird price or the full price, full ticket price. So, I mean, for those who are subscribed at the old $8 a month version, if you went to the conference, I mean, you already, that saved you more than two-thirds of what you already paid for your annual membership. But we also have live events like the Axel Merck meeting that's coming up here that I just mentioned. We're also going to be bringing back the Ask Anything Live Advisor Q&As on a regular basis. Again, those will be made live available exclusively to the premium subscribers. But now we have another thing that I'm going to be launching probably in the next couple of weeks. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what to call it, but for lack of a better name right now, I'm calling it the Macro Pass, which is, the brand promise of Thoughtful Money is bringing in the best minds in money in the markets to you, the viewer. A lot of the people that appear on this channel have premium analysis that they publish, newsletters, whatnot. I have reached out to a number of the folks that I respect the most who come on this channel and asked them if they wouldn't mind sharing periodically some of their premium reports with this audience. And so I've gotten overwhelming response to this. So it's going to be on a weekly basis. Each week, there's going to be a new premium report from one of the people who appear on this channel that's going to be sent to my premium Substack subscribers. I'll be sharing the names with you of everybody that's on the list, but right now it's already crossing into the several dozen stage. So it basically, this is sort of like one of those. I'm trying to think of the right analogy here. It's kind of maybe like with those wine bars that you go into where you don't have to buy the full bottle. You can just buy a glass of each of the really expensive wines there. So you get to sort of sample them all. Maybe it's like a ski pass. Like I know up in Tahoe here, there's a whole bunch of different mountains. You buy a ski pass, you can ski any one of those mountains on any day. So this is a way for you going forward to get a ton of additional, really valuable premium content from a wide range of these experts. And again, that's all wrapped into this the low $15 a month price, less than 50 cents a day. You get all of those things that I just mentioned. So more detail on that, especially the Macro Pass as it launches in the next couple of weeks. But I just wanted to make sure that folks really understood what the premium Substack subscription offers to you. All right. And then just as we begin to wrap up here, as Lance and I talked about, before we got into the whole political form of governance discussion here, the markets are overstretched here. There's definitely increasing uncertainty heading into an election year. If you're having trouble or concerns navigating that on your own, especially if you're like most people, you have a real life, you've got way other demands on your time and your focus. I'll reiterate my usual advice that just about everybody watching this program, unless they're a highly experienced and successful DIY investor, work under the guidance of a good professional financial advisor who takes into account all the macro issues that Lance and I have talked about here in this conversation, as well as the macro views of all the folks that come on this channel with me. If you've got a good advisor who's doing all that for you, great, stick with them. But if you don't, or you'd like a second opinion from one who does, maybe even Lance and his team there at Real Investment Advice, then consider scheduling a free consultation with one of the financial advisors that Thoughtful Money endorses. To do that, just go fill out the short form at thoughtfulmoney.com. Only takes you a couple seconds to fill out the form. You're going to get a completely personalized and bespoke consultation with these guys where they tell you exactly what they think you should do, given your own unique, specific situation and needs. There's no cost to these consultations. There's no commitment to work with these guys. It's just a free public service that they offer. All right. Well, in wrapping things up here, if you are going to spend your time between now and next week's weekly market recap, abiding like the dude Lebowski and abiding like the dude Roberts, then do us a favor, show us that by hitting the like button and then clicking on the red subscribe button below, as well as that little bell icon right next to it. As usual, Lance, I'm going to give you the last word.
Hey, have a great week and enjoy your spring break, and we'll see you when you get back.
All right. Thanks so much, Lance. Everybody else, thanks so much for watching.